The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. It's the FA Cup and Premier League combo. Heartache for Swansea as City come back at a VAR-less Liberty Stadium. Heartache for Millwall as their keeper flaps at the wrong time to let Brighton in. Wolves beat United and Watford see off Palace. Meanwhile, Liverpool sneak back to the top of the table without anyone noticing, while there are goals galore at the London Stadium and Burnley slip up against 10-man Leicester. A big win for Sheffield United in the Championship and a lovely allowed goal at the bottom of League One. In Europe, Zidane begins with a win at Real. Messi gets another hat-trick. Juve lose for the first time in the league this season, and Rooney scores a hat-trick in MLS. We'll do all that, answer your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Jonathan Wilson, how are you?
I'm all right, thanks, how are you?
I'm very well, nice to see you. Barney Ronnie, how are you?
Yeah, fine, thanks. Yeah, I survived my trip in through a decimated Bermondsey, people weeping in the streets.
Absolutely.
Burning cars.
Yes. Were you there?
No change there.
Barry Glendenning.
Hello.
At 8:20 last night, you sent us all a photo of a dog in a hat with the line, "I put a hat on a dog." happy day after St. Patrick's Day to you. How are you?
I'm all right, thank you. Yeah. All things considered. Mm-hmm.
Are you planning to lead this pod, or are you hoping Jonathan and Barney do most of the work?
We'll see how it goes, but I would hate to monopolise conversation with such heavyweights here, so I may take of a backseat.
The yoghurt pots for hats roll very seriously
yes.
Today. Okay.
I just point out I didn't get in until after two this morning because of delays on the trains back from Liverpool.
Okay. So. Do you have any excuses, Barney?
No excuses. I never do, and I feel a deep sense of shame every time I interact with sport.
Swansea 2, Manchester City 3. It's a great game, Jonathan. You've got a feel for Swansea, haven't you?
Yeah. I mean, there was this, the City wave was pretty overwhelming, but Swansea will look at the second and third City goals and we'll wonder whether on another day decisions might have gone their way.
There was no VAR. Aguero afterwards, Pep said, "I'm sorry it was offside. I don't understand why VAR is not used in this competition at this stage. Hopefully
just
next season this won't happen."
Watching the will to live seep out of Burnley.
So it's been 90 seconds. We've had the word decisions and we've had the word VAR.
Barney, I imagine you're very exercised about VAR being in some grounds and not in others. I've heard people say it's a disgrace.
No, you see, the problem with VAR discussions, like so many other discussions, is they're really pointlessly polarised. You either hate it and think it's absolute scum of the earth, or you think the people who don't want it are Philistines and idiots and Luddites, which they may be. But I mean, you can see there's good things about it, and it's a nice idea that sport can be perfectible. But it's become what we talk about. It's become the thing. And obviously that's a problem. I guess it all comes down to whether you think football is a nice piece of poetry or prose, or whether you think it's a really nice piece of maths and there are answers there. And being on either sides of that debate doesn't mean you have to hate the other person and think they're a cretin, but
can a great equation not have a certain poetry?
I wonder. See, Wilson is clearly on the math side of this debate.
No, I'm not sure I am.
Oh, really? No, absolutely it can. But most people don't understand equations to that degree and just see quite a simplistic picture. And that's why we have to have these stupid shouting matches about it. It's a real shame,
It's unfortunate. Graham Potter took it on the chin, said these things happen, and they do. They were unlucky.
I have to say, that bit of the argument I don't understand. The fact that it's in some grounds and not others. There's a lot of things that are different from one ground to another. There's obvious reasons why. I mean, the Swansea one is a particularly odd thing that they are set up to have it, and the fact they're not a Premier League ground, the FA decided not to have it. So that is a slightly strange decision. But this idea you have consistency across the board at all levels, it just doesn't happen.
It doesn't make any sense. So long as if you were to have it for the first half and not for the second half, that would be inconsistent.
Or just as a surprise.
Yeah, or not to tell anyone you're using it. But the fact is, as long as it's either there or not there for the entire game, it's one of those things people say on sort of popular sports, where all we ask for is consistency. It's become one of the things people say, as though that's a thing that has any meaning in itself.
I think football is better when there's less consistency, and pitches were radically different sizes rather than there being a sort of Premier League template. When goal nets look different, when stands look different, when grass weaves were different, We've homogenised football.
I love the idea of referees doing it in secret and just sort of spending 5 minutes just like, what are you doing? Nothing. It's a missed opportunity, though, for Barry, isn't it? For Barry?
it really is.
Life, arguably.
We weren't supposed to talk about that now.
It is. Life is a missed opportunity for Barry. This game was a missed opportunity for Barry Town, wasn't it? Because they weren't even playing. It's a missed opportunity for Swansea Barry, who played brilliantly.
And yeah,
it was a lovely second goal.
It was an absolute beauty. You know, they sort of out Man City to Man City. But I do have sympathy for Swansea. They were horribly unlucky, and they've had a rough time of it this season. Their owners don't particularly care about the club. They've asset stripped, they've sold all their best players, and Graham Potter's done a wonderful job there this season, all things considered, with one if not both of his arms tied behind his back. And it is unfortunate, but you know, life sucks. Get over it.
Also,
and you've just pointed out that my life in particular sucks. Thank you for that.
All right.
Also, I mean, they were unlucky, but I mean, they're playing a team who create lots and lots of opportunities, have lots of possession, are extremely powerful. And in the end, some of those little moments will go against you. I mean, it's luck and not luck. You may say life's a missed opportunity for Barry, but how many opportunities has he had?
Can we stop going down this avenue, please?
You're slightly emotional. You had a hard day yesterday.
I want to watch videos of raccoons eating fruit.
Do you think you'd have missed fewer of those opportunities had VAR been available in your life?
Jonathan O'Brien says, bloody hell, no wonder Man City are in with a sniff of the quadruple. Here are their cup runs so far. The League Cup, Oxford, Fulham, Leicester, Burton, Chelsea. The FA Cup, Rotherham, Burnley, Newport, Swansea, Brighton. Europe, Lyon, Shakhtar, Hoffenheim, Schalke.
I used to work with Jonathan O'Brien at Hot Press magazine in Dublin.
Okay.
He's a Manchester United fan. Mm-hmm. So, you know,
okay, so this
he likes to get the little digs in at City, but he does make a very good point.
It's the nature of cup competitions, isn't it?
Absolutely. Christopher Norvell, I know you make a good point, Barney, about the luck. There were some blocks and saves that were very fortunate for Swansea, but that penalty is agonising, right, isn't it? Because it was a soft penalty, and then it hits him on the way back. And if he dived the wrong way, that ball wasn't bouncing back to a City player, I don't think.
Yeah, but the sport is a series of collisions that either go one way or another way, and out of which we make a narrative however we want to. So I imagine every single game of football that's ever been played is pegged out around a series of fortunate collisions. It's just now that we can stare at them in very close, slowed down detail and say, what if that had happened another way? I mean, it's very interesting, but we will be constantly obsessed with the idea that life is either bad luck or good luck or bias if we convince ourselves that there should be some logic to this.
How do you see the random collisions of Tottenham, Manchester City in the Champions League?
Oh, that's fascinating, isn't it? I mean, I can only see Manchester City winning it, really, just because they're such a compelling team and because, they're obviously the favourites. But
to what extent do you think the witch will guide those collisions?
Ram does say Man City have been lucky at key moments as the specialist in the occult. Does Barney think they've used up all their luck for their season and now will suffer a few key decisions going against
them? First things first, I am anti-witch's curse. I believe there is logic and finance behind these things. But you could equally say that City don't have any Champions League winning players in their team. This is a step further for them. It's not been a competition they've waltzed through with a sense of certainty. So in a way, it's... while a witch's curse meets another witch's curse, and whichever spell is stronger will clearly win. I suspect the spell which has spent more money than any other club team in the history of football may be stronger on this occasion.
The witch's curse.
After the international break, City go Fulham, Brighton in the FA Cup semi-final, Spurs, Palace, Spurs, Spurs, United. The last of those Spurs games being in the league. So Spurs go Liverpool, City, Huddersfield, City, City, West Ham. Do Spurs have a bit of hope because, Jonathan, they've got a day off when Man City have got to play Brighton in the semi-final, the FA Cup?
Possibly. I mean, they've got a bit of hope because they're a very good team. And while they haven't been able to maintain consistency to maintain a title challenge, while that now is called into question whether they're going to finish in the top four, in a one-off game, well, a two-off game, you know, why not? You know, they were the second half of the first against Dortmund. They were brilliant. If they play like that against City, yeah, they can be.
As we said, City played Brighton in the semi-final. They got past Millwall on penalties. Oh, Barney, are you okay?
It was a good game. You know, I felt sorry for the goalkeeper. Millwall have a problem with goalies. I heard on the news coming in this morning the terrible news that Jordan Archer has been ruled out of Scotland's squad, which may be some good news finally for the Scots. I mean, they're a problem with Millwall. He had a good game either side of the penalties and that terrible mistake.
It's impossible. It's David Martin, son of Alvin.
Is he?
Yeah.
I didn't know.
It's impossible to fathom that mistake, Barry.
Yeah, I would put it down to, I don't know, panic, buckling under pressure, because it was completely inexplicable. He could have conceivably have caught the ball. He could have knocked it to one side of the bar the post over the bar. And I don't think it was particularly windy or anything. It was just a horrendous gaffe while Millwall were under incredible pressure.
Not the keeper who played against Sunderland last season, is he?
Were there two bad mistakes in that game?
That was a 2-2 draw and all four were goalkeeping errors.
I think that was Archer, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the goalies make mistakes, don't they? And you immediately have to analyse why that happened. I mean, players make mistakes all the time. David De Gea made the mistake the other week and we've already had a sort of massive debate about how this could be possible. I think it was a really windy, wet, exhausting day with all sorts of things going on and he blinked for a microsecond and that's that he'll be remembered for that appalling mistake in the 95th minute.
After a defeat like that, you have that heroic sense of pride in defeat, Barney. Is that how you feel right now?
Well, the best news, if you are a Millwall fan, came with yesterday was actually a great day for the club with the suggestion of a possible 12-point penalty for Birmingham City. That would be more crucial to the rest of the season than getting the chance to lose to Man City in the FA Cup.
I mean, Neil Harris afterwards, you know, defended his goalkeeper as he should, and he did play well apart from that, Rick. But Harris was more angry about the first goal because the defending for it was just abysmal. You know, two Brighton players beat four Millwall players to get the ball into the net, and that just shouldn't have happened.
Sometimes happens. They have a really good defence, Millwall. I really enjoyed the final penalty in a way, even though it was agonising and I had crying children to deal with, because I really like Jake Cooper, the player who missed it. He's a fantastic player. He's huge. He was Millwall's leading assist giver this season because he's brilliant at knocking the ball down. He's a centre-half. And he's got this incredible left foot where he absolutely spanks it forward. He's our master of the long ball. And he took that penalty as though he
was channel ball.
Launching the ball. And we said he's either going to break the bar or it's going to go into the stand, and fair enough, he was true to his principles. He used his primary skill. It just didn't go in, but he's a really good player. He's really good. He was sent off against Leicester for absolutely destroying Ahmed Musa. He just lunged into him and actually sort of won the game with that tackle, even though he was red carded, because it kind of was so shocking they stopped playing for 10 minutes.
I'm curious to know, Barney, how you deal with crying children who are emotional because their team is lost. I imagine you probably mock at them.
No, I mean, it's a fine line between, you know, mockery and just physical violence.
Marvellous. Did you want a serious answer, Barry? No. This result, of course, means the first visitors to Spurs' new stadium will be Crystal Palace on the 2nd of April. Now, the other semi-final is going to be Watford-Wolves after Wolves beat Manchester United 2-1. What a brilliant performance from Wolves. I know Manchester United might have been under par and Solskjaer said that, but Wolves were superb, I thought, Jonathan.
Yeah, as they have been relatively frequently this season. I think they are a better side against good sides. But on the break, I think they were as good as anybody in the Premier League. And Hotter and Jimenez, that link-up works very well. It's a really good performance. They deserved it.
Mags asks, is Raul Jimenez having a £30 million option to buy looking like a mistake from Benfica the longer the season goes on? Or is that still too much for him?
I don't know. I honestly don't understand money anymore. I mean, that's what Benfica do, isn't it? They sell players at a profit. Yeah, the way Jimenez is playing now, you'd say £30 million is about the market rate. So, and also, you know, Wolves' situation. Having deals with clubs in Portugal seems to be a thing they do.
Defensively, look, only four teams have conceded fewer in the Premier League, so they are doing well at both ends, Wolves, aren't they? They become the first club, this is according to Grace Note Live, to eliminate both Liverpool and Manchester United in a single FA Cup campaign since Everton in 2008-2009. Two defeats in a row now for Manchester United, Barry. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer says this was a big step backwards, mainly because of the quality of possession and the passing. The season is unravelling.
I would think that's a little extreme. United had a bad day at the office. That's allowed. Don't think there's any shame in getting beaten by Wolves when they're playing well. They're capable of giving anyone a game. They're quite odd, actually, because they've also lost twice against Huddersfield, but Johnson makes a good point about them raising their game against better quality opposition. United definitely didn't play well, but I think a little too much is being read into, you know, two consecutive defeats against two decent sides. And I'm kind of surprised Solskjaer said that, to be honest.
It's probably quite useful for them to lose a couple of games now, isn't it? I mean, the upswing from getting rid of the King of Pain possibly made them perform. But there are some sort of profound problems with the entire structure of the club.
And they've still got a load of players out with injury. I mean, it's there's huge underlying issues. But even if it weren't, if you're without sort of eight or nine first-team players, it's hard.
But so given those underlying issues, do you think Ed Woodward is smart enough to see that Solskjaer is still the right man, or if he is
He might be the right man. His instincts are clearly good and he loves the club and he's not interested in short-term fixes to gild his own reputation, which certain other managers in the past may have been interested in. You know, he loves the club. He loves the process. He understands about players coming through. He talks the talk. He's very good for the brand. He makes them look and sound like Manchester United you want to be noodle partners with, which is actually very important. You know, that's what that club is for now. It's a commercial machine. And with Solskjaer, they look and sound. They're playing against Barcelona. It almost doesn't matter if they win or lose that tie, because that's just what Man United should be doing. And millions and millions and millions of people around the world will watch that and will see Manchester United playing against Messi. And Solskjaer's given them that gift. And the club hierarchy will only care about that this season. They've got that date in the diary.
But are you sure it doesn't matter what happens at all? I mean,
I think it's probably quite good if we say it doesn't matter. Okay. Can we just say that? Because I personally don't give them much chance.
No, do you, Jonathan?
No, Barcelona are obviously favourites. But Solskjaer, well, apparently he has had happy times in Barcelona before. I've heard that rumour.
I'm not aware of that.
I'd have to check.
No. So he's fine then. So there's no stress.
No,
about.
He's a bald fjord. I was very proud of that joke on Saturday. I got force fed Jaeger bombs at 2:30 on Saturday afternoon.
Right. Ugh. In the afternoon.
I know.
Who by?
I don't even know who he was. He's just a bloke in the pub. He's a mate of a mate. We were on the way.
Can't you just say no, thank you?
Have you been in a pub in Sunderland?
I've got a lot of willpower when it comes to forced drinking.
Right,
like it's when I get to a different level.
And I was about to go out into the wind and cold and sleet to watch Sunderland v Walsall, so it didn't seem like the worst idea. But anyway, I was quite pleased. Bald fjord, like bald fjord. You see, bald fjord.
Yeah, but he's not bald.
He's not bald.
No, that's the joke. The joke is that you're doing a pun on the wrong bit of the word. It's like.
It's quite meta. So look, they've got Watford and Wolves to come, Manchester United, after the international break. I mean, it's feasible that they could go on a really terrible run, right? But is the fact that Solskjaer's got them, is finishing sixth and going out to Barcelona still good from where they were?
Absolutely, yeah. And the place just feels better. You feel there's possibilities there. It's the first time since Ferguson left that there's been a lightness about them. And they have. What I found interesting is in all those managers, they seem to have had the same problem, this very sort of trapped, static football. They've been utterly sort of leaden. And for once, that's gone. And you felt that he's performed an exorcism on the spirit of the kind of, the past.
How badly do you think things have to go from now to the end of the season for him not to get the job?
I think they could go quite well and he still wouldn't get the job. I mean, presumably there was a succession plan in place that wasn't him, and they'll still try and pursue that. But if he finishes fourth, if he beats Barcelona, he'll get the job.
And what you said, there are lots of, huge problems still at Manchester United. What are they?
They're owned by some capitalists who just want to strip money out of the club, which is fine. I mean, that's legal. That's a common way of owning a company, but that doesn't really help.
They don't have a director of football.
Yeah, there's a bit of a power vacuum. They need more support. They need more people who are solely interested in the football side of the club and who have a say.
But in terms of a squad, is it?
Well, it's really unbalanced. I think scouting and recruitment has generally not been good since Woodward took over from David Gill. If you go to Old Trafford now, it sort of feels shabby.
It does feel shabby, doesn't it? Yeah, they need a bit of love pouring into the stadium.
You mean the actual stadium?
Yeah,
is starting to look a bit...
Yeah, we moan about press facilities, which are, I would say, of the top six clubs, significantly the worst in the Premier League. But I think that's a reflection of wider issues, that I think the experience for supporters is not as good as it is. And, you know, it's slightly unfair to compare it to, say, Tottenham or Chelsea, who obviously have plans to move somewhere better and bigger. So you understand why... I mean, yeah, I'm talking Tottenham when they were still at White Hart Lane. You understand why there are issues with their facilities, but they were looking to improve them. Whereas United, I'm not sure there's any plans to develop Old Trafford or, you know. But it sort of feels like a place that hasn't really had much done to it in sort of 10, 15 years.
So Wolves will play Watford, who beat Crystal Palace. Reward for Javi Gracia resting those players against Manchester City in the league, Bez?
Absolutely. I thought the criticism of that was weird. There's no reason why you shouldn't have rested them, and it's going to be a good semi-final because Watford, like Wolves on their day, are really good, and Javier Gracia really seems to know what he's doing. They've got some excellent players, you know, Decore, Capu, Troidini, giving it loads up front. He'll be a handful for any defence on a good day, and I'm looking forward to that. You know, they will be delighted to have avoided Man City, and one of them is going to a cup final.
But I was going to say, it's an interesting matchup, isn't it? Because I still don't really understand the Wolves model completely. I really like Wolves. I used to go there. It was the first club I used to go and report them quite a lot when I first started doing this. And I think it's the friendliest place in football. Even, you know, people in the streets around the ground are just really nice. And I'm really glad it's working there. It's a really functional little place. But I don't understand if they're doing what Watford are, if they're trying to do well so they can make a profit by selling players or what. Well, I mean, Watford are very open about that. Maybe both these teams are trying to win the FA Cup so they can make a massive profit on the players who won it and sell them off 2 days later. I'm not sure.
How do you feel, Jonathan, about reserve goalkeepers playing in the FA Cup and then sticking with them? Obviously, United played Romero. He made some great saves. I wonder if De Gea would have saved that second one with his feet because Romero went with his hands. And then you've got Aurelio Gomez. But then Ben Foster's, you know, there's an emotional pull for both of those with Watford. Well, and Gomez has the jersey for the FA Cup.
I think that depends entirely what conversations the manager and the goalkeepers have had at the start of the season. You know, if a manager said to a goalkeeper, you will play in the Cup come what may, then you have to stick with him. If he said, look, well...
If he said you will play in the Cup until May, different.
Yes, exactly. So, I mean, I think that always depends just on the internal dynamic, and it's different according to who the keepers are. I mean, fundamentally, I think swapping around your keepers is a bad idea. I think it's... it places an unfair stress on your defence because I think that relationship between keeper and defence is hugely important. So I think if you can sort of it's easier to change the defenders and change the keeper. So when England had that habit of swapping Chilton and Clements, I mean particularly given how they were very very different keepers, I thought it was insanity. The same with Jojo Bell and Thomas Nkunku when Cameroon did that. It doesn't work. The different goalkeepers, you need consistency. So I'm never kind of comfortable with swapping keepers around. I understand why managers might find it useful to give their second choice keeper a bit of a run out and keep them interested, but it's not an ideal situation.
That'll do for part one. In part two, we'll do the Premier League.
It's time to focus.
They rush the baby to the hospital, and that's when they start accusing Imelda. They say, well, you tried to kill your daughter.
Today in Focus is the new daily podcast from The Guardian. Join me, Anushka Astana, for the best stories from our journalists around the world. Subscribe now to Today in Focus from The Guardian.
Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. We've got two live shows coming up. Thanks to everyone who came to the show in Hackney especially to the two players who registered and played for my football team on Saturday. That was greatly appreciated. A good 3-2 win away at Alexandra Palace. They were registered.
You only registered them because the secretary of Alexandra Palace was at the gig as well.
Yes, I know.
And he tweeted that he was aware you were trying to recruit ringers.
In a throwaway comment, say, no one's Mally Pally here. And for their secretary to put his hand up and say, yes, I'm here, was a bit of a letdown.
Are you sure it was secretary, not just me having a laugh?
No, because I saw him at the game. Yeah. And to anyone who played this weekend, God, it was windy. Anyway, on the 22nd of April, we're live at SWG3 in Glasgow. Me, you, Barry, you, Wilson, and you and Murray. And then on the 23rd, we drop Wilson and we bring in Lars Sivertsen to go to Elmwood Hall in Belfast.
Rest.
Wilson. Oh, we're resting, yes. Rotation. Exactly right. Yes, so me, Barry, Ewan, and Lars in Belfast, Elmwood Hall. Please come to both or one of those. I'd suggest doing just one of the two. It'd be incredible commitment to fly with us and do both.
There was a guy on Friday who told me he was his fourth Football Weekly Live that he's attended.
I can guarantee none of those had me as a member of the panel. I'm a guarantee of no return.
Fulham 1, Liverpool 2. Liverpool go back to the top of the league then with that victory. What do we take from it, Jonathan?
Liverpool were very, very comfortable. And yet they were comfortable in a way that made you think Fulham have a chance here. And then, I don't really care who wins the title, but it would have been absolutely hilarious if Amanda Costa had pulled the title had been Ryan Babel. But Liverpool, again, as they keep doing, found themselves in difficulty and found a way out of it.
And the pod did erupt when Ryan Babel scored, because there was a lot of Ryan Babel love last season, wasn't there? And proof that Van Dijk is human, I guess.
But. Yeah, I think it was a really good win. I'd just like to point out that whoever wins the league from here, nobody is bottling anyone. No one's a choker. I mean, that is exactly the sort of... I was there in Munich and that was such a huge draining occasion. And they did really give... I mean, it was a slightly tedious game in many ways, but they were so up for that. And to go and then play Fulham, it was a real, potential banana skin. And to win it after they've made that mistake for the penalty, nobody's choking here. There are two really good teams. But obviously, Van Dijk... potential player of the year, probably not now. I mean, that was a disastrous error.
He should never play football again.
He's a fraud, a ponytailed fraud.
What was the reaction to Mane's first goal in Munich? Because it was just one of those incredible moments. You just...
Yeah, it was amazing because it's a really loud stadium. And they have a call and response thing across the stadium, the two Bayern ends, and the noise is fantastic. It's a brilliant stadium. When we talk about fan experience, they play this brilliant Bavarian pomp rock before kickoff. Actually, they play Thunderstruck by AC/DC, and it's brilliant. The sound system there is fantastic. But that goal just killed the air, just left the stadium, and then the Liverpool fans are right up in the gods. You just heard this kind of white noise going across the ground, and it was really a gobsmacking moment. It was great, actually, and to come off that high and then go to play Fulham in their windy little stadium by the Thames and to win like that was, I thought, really good. So if they don't win the league, it's not going to be for some sort of mental fragility.
And look, Sadio Mane has just stepped up, hasn't he, Baz, when I think Salah's not scored in seven, and you just need one of them to perform, and it doesn't mean that Salah's a bad player, and it doesn't mean Mane's the best player in the world, but he is doing
it. It absolutely does.
But he is really doing it right now, isn't he?
Yeah, and he seems to have a great partnership with Roberto Firmino, and I'm not sure what else to say. Really, he's playing really well. We know how capable he is, and if he wasn't banging in those goals, you sense Liverpool would be in rather a spot of bother and probably not top of the league.
But the goalkeeping from Rico for the pen was poor, wasn't it? And
I think he's a very poor goalkeeper, and I'm not sure why he's in the Fulham first team, because they have two who are better than him.
Yeah, the Salah thing is really interesting. Salah, one's got to be better than the other. I mean, I'm a bit of a Salah doubter. He's scored so many really quite weird goals, and you kind of thought, is he going to be able to sustain that? And also the sort of triumphalism about, oh, he's the best player in the world now, was a bit annoying. So I kind of was waiting for him to dip so I could think, yes, I was right about him all along. But I have to say, even though he hadn't scored for a few games, in Munich, I really thought I saw a really good side to him. He really did contribute to that win. He was right up and down the flank. He just played like a really good member of the team and surprised me. So I thought it was better than going out and scoring a goal in many ways. He just looked like a really good player away against Bayern Munich.
It's interesting, actually. It's risky in your career to have a season that good. Are you better off just getting 20 every year and then your expectations won't rise? Yeah, unless you're Messi, of course.
Yeah, it's obviously really hard to sustain it. I mean, obviously, say, for example, you were to write a book about, I don't know, football tactics or something.
With a shape in it.
Yeah, with some kind of shape. And that somehow, some inexplicable reason, that caught the public imagination. I can imagine you spend the rest of your career kind of chasing that. And it might have been better to just do like a pot boiler, maybe about playing park football or something. And you don't constantly try and chase that early success, which can be so sad at times.
No, it can be. I entirely agree. However, subsequent contracts are inflated as a result of that one successful season.
We were talking about the five penalty takers you'd have if you needed all to score for you to live. And if one missed, you would be killed. James Milner could be in that five.
He'd be all five, I think, yeah.
You can't have all five as Milner.
Four?
Okay, you can have four as Milner. Who's your other one?
Matt Letizier.
Okay, yeah. Well, Jonathan, you're still alive.
What if Mark Crossley's in goal?
I would toss a deep fried foodstuff to distract him.
Liverpool got Porto in the Champions League.
I think if you tossed a deep fried foodstuff, certainly the Letizia of old might be distracted by that as well.
I would back Crossley's pace to get him there first. And then Letizia, in a fit of pique, would score with even more emphasis than usual.
It would be sad if you died as a result of a waywardly thrown egg McMuffin.
Liverpool have Porto in the Champions League. Several bullets dodged there, eh, Barney?
Yeah, I mean, Porto, a good team. But I think it's a pretty good draw for them, isn't it? And they will travel with confidence. I think it's Man City and Barcelona's to lose, really. You don't want to play either of them till the final. And over two legs, both really, really hard to beat because they've got so many good players and because of the way they play.
Everton 2, Chelsea 0. Patrick says, can Everton win the Everton Cup? Jonathan, you were there.
Yeah, it was a really weird game. It was very hard to write about because nothing made any sense. It was, as Barney says, football has been a series of fortunate collisions. There's never been a game that's been such a series of collisions, had no pattern at all. Chelsea, totally dominant first half, conceded the goal early in the second, melted totally. So Everton were rubbish, and then Chelsea capitulated. So I don't think either of them are particularly good, but neither of them are consistent. I sort of wrote quite a critical piece about Everton because I wasn't convinced by them at all. And then I've got a bit of flack for that this morning. But they've won two out of the last seven games. And they played they could have been 3-0 down in 8 minutes. So they probably did deserve to win it yesterday because they scored two goals and Chelsea didn't score any. But it's a very strange game.
I saw somebody, I forget who, questioning the Gonzalo Higuain
he's so heavy.
Yes, that and his pace being... Someone saying it's amazing they found the one centre-forward slower than Olivier Giroud.
Yeah. I mean, he had that one shot in the second half when he absolutely leathered it and Pickford made a very good save down to his left. So, you know, if you put the ball in front of his feet, or I guess in front of his head, he is dangerous. But he's so slow. How did he score so many goals in Serie A? I don't get it.
The race for the top four is hotting up, Barney. Spurs, 61 points from 30. Arsenal, 60 from 30. Manchester United, 58 from 30. And Chelsea, 57 from 30. Are you frothing at the mouth with excitement about it?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite exciting, particularly for all those London-based journalists out there who are obviously, you know, while supporting midweek trips on Virgin trains as a great thing generally, interested to see how it's going. I mean, I think I've got a feeling Arsenal will finish in the top four, even though they're not very good. They seem to be... They've got a few difficult away fixtures, but they turned it into a fortress at home, and they've got players who just seem to pop up and win moments for them. So I quite fancy them to end up in there, and I think Spurs will stay in there as well.
Nick Ames tweeting, not that I didn't enjoy Everton-Chelsea, but the afternoon's biggest takeaway is that Jonathan Wilson literally has an Uber rating of 5.0. Who has that?
Still got it after last night's Uber home from Euston. I don't know. I think, I mean, I guess I'm just perfect as a human being.
So I'm sort of high fours. I think I'm about 4-6. And I'm very upset that anyone has ever put me lower than a 5. What haven't I done?
Do you tip?
Yeah, sometimes. Is that it?
I think it is.
There's no way Wilson tips. He's too tight.
I always tip.
Oh, do you?
Is that how you get a five?
Tipping on Uber is amazing. Cause
I always put a pound on, yeah.
It's really good. You can tip without that embarrassing interchange where you feel, as an English person, that this is somehow really awkward and you're implying this person is your servant. You can just tip remotely. So I tip lavishly all the time.
I called an Uber once for a mate who was really drunk and the car refused to take him. And I thought that would affect my rating, but it didn't. I was very surprised.
I mean, what difference does a rating make? Do you get the cars faster?
I don't think. I think if it's below 4, I suspect people start thinking, I'll swerve that one.
I just feel but pressure.
A 5 is quite amazing.
I didn't even know that you could look this up until yesterday. I was very excited.
Do you shake their hand? Would you?
Yeah, I do shake their hand. I mean, as long as they've delivered me to the right place.
Okay.
Thanks very much.
Do you engage in conversation or not?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Anyway, Chelsea saw off Dynamo Kiev very easily on Thursday night. They've got Slavia Prague. The winners play Eintracht Frankfurt or Benfica. On the Europa League, Arsenal's great comeback against Rennes. He's then with a tough tie Napoli. The winners play Valencia or Villarreal. So it's an easier path for Chelsea than Arsenal, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, the dream obviously is a Chelsea-Arsenal final in Baku. I imagine Vienna Airport would be particularly horrific the day before that game.
And how did we rate Arsenal's performance against Rennes?
It's good. I mean, I thought they were a little bit unlucky in the first leg with the... I mean, the sending off was correct, but obviously had a huge impact on the way the game went. And I think Arsenal actually... their improvement under Emery has been slightly... it hasn't got quite the credit it deserves because they are capable of a sort of seismically bad performance every now and again. But the fact they are so good at home... I think, yeah, Emery deserves great credit for that. And he's made them tactically very flexible. You know, they've used like 6 different starting formations this season.
And there are players who've improved in the squad. I mean, I thought Ainsley Maitland-Niles, who played quite well recently, played well again there. And he's an academy kid who wasn't really getting... I mean, to be fair, Wenger kept him in. I've always quite liked him. There was that bizarre story about his mother. I'm sure she won't mind me telling this. Who one of his parents get very involved and she was banned from coming to watch games because she kept haranguing the home bench. Why isn't he playing more? And so she was banned from watching Arsenal youth team games. And then they played a game, I think, at the Emirates, and she snuck in and was seen suddenly standing up again, haranguing, and she had to be escorted out by security. And you'd think Wenger might have sort of cut his losses there, but they had kind of showdown talks. And I mean, obviously very passionately involved. And now here he is playing. She was right. She was right all along. He's playing in the first team and doing really well. And he seems like a very nice bloke.
West Ham 4, Huddersfield 3. Well, this was fun, wasn't it? Only the second time Huddersfield has scored 2 or more in a game this season, yet they still lost. Jonathan, does that sum up Huddersfield's season?
Sums up West Ham, I think. I mean, I was bewildered that West Ham side managed to concede 4 to AFC Wimbledon. But to concede 3 to Huddersfield as well, it's one of those freakish games and nobody could defend set plays. What I did think was interesting was Jan Sievert's reaction. He was so angry. And you sort of think, it's really early in his Huddersfield career to be getting that worked up. And you wonder whether giving him the job when they gave it to him was really that wise. Because he sort of expends a lot of credit before he gets around to the real business of next season. That he saw it with, I think, Paul Jewell at Derby when he took over before, you know, he replaced Billy Davis in their 11-point season. And straight away, the start of the next season, I think they lost the opening game and he was under pressure. And you wonder if the same thing might happen with Jan Sievert, that there's not going to be any honeymoon for him, that immediately it's going to be, yeah, this bloke led us to 10 defeats at the end of last season or whatever, and he's going to need immediate results next season, which obviously in a championship won't be easy. Assuming they do go down.
But that's not the first time he's been in a massive funk after a game as well, because I think after the last defeat he was similarly enraged about the efforts of his players. And, we all know they're going down, but I do think he needs to get a few wins on the board before they...
It's hard. It would be hard to have done worse. You know, he would have done well to have...
I don't watch enough of Huddersfield to know if there's been any discernible improvement in the way they go about their business, but
Although they've been pretty poor all season. But it's quite common, isn't it, now for managers to be... They've started being very critical of players. That seems to be a thing now. What I really enjoyed about that West Ham game was they've really turned up the bubbles at the stadium. It's that desperate sort of thing, like a really bad party where you keep turning the music up. And so now the whole... There used to be a few bubbles at the beginning. Now the whole thing is covered in bubbles all the time. And I really enjoy seeing Manuel Pellegrini's huge, austere, terrifying... Like, he's so angry about everything. His face is... It's like the ancient kind of Beowulf striding around with all these bubbles flying past him. It just... It's like, what is this bubbles? He just looks really funny. And keep going with the bubble. They must have a massive contract with a bubble supplier. Like, going to bubble it until it feels like home.
Burnley 1, Leicester 2. Does Harry Maguire get a win bonus, Barry? He was off after 3.5 minutes.
I would imagine he does if he played, if he started the game, I presume. You know, if he came on as a late sub, he'd get a win bonus. So presumably if he starts, he gets a win bonus, even though he only lasts 3 minutes.
He'd get his £25 fine off the FA as well for the red card.
Yeah. Harry Maguire sent off after 3.5 minutes, replaced by Wes Morgan, who broke a Premier League record for the amount of time between a substitute coming on and then scoring. 86 minutes. The previous holder was Jim Magilton in 1996, who came on the 8th minute to replace Richard Dryden and scored a penalty in the 89th. And the penalty, I think it looks like Egil Ostenstad is... in front of him when he strikes the ball. He's encroached that far. But this is a terrible result for Burnley, Barney, isn't it? And they're in massive trouble.
Yeah, they are, yeah. I know everyone likes Sean Dyche, and he's been on the media a lot, but I'm not really a fan of them as a team. I don't particularly enjoy watching them. I can see it was a great feat of organisation to get all these players to defend like that. It's great, but I find Dyche sort of moans on. He makes these pointed comments about people diving, where his players equally like a little bit of gamesmanship, if you like, heavy tackles and so on. I don't know. I know it's not a very fashionable thing to say, but if they get relegated, they'll probably deserve it for playing a certain way and not playing it well enough.
And they are in trouble now. I mean, 4 defeats in a row. Their last 4 games, Chelsea, City, Everton, Arsenal. So that game on April the 13th at home to Cardiff, that looks crucial.
Yeah. How good is James Maddison? How good could he be? It's a lovely free kick. I think he's the full package, Barry.
Yeah, hugely impressed with him. He was, I think, the absolute standout player at Norwich last season. How much did he go for? He seems to have gone quite
25?
Cheaply. Right.
25 mil.
Okay. Well, I would imagine if you know, you'd get double that for him now. But, he's a very confident young man, like James Ward-Prowse. You know, he has a very high opinion of himself, and it's quite justified. His dead ball skills are incredible. Like, that free kick is pretty much unstoppable, unsavable. And the way him and Vardy were just getting between the lines of the Burnley players and, you know, passing, linking up brilliantly... He is excellent. I would imagine he will go far. Like, you know, he's definitely capable of playing in top one of the big six sides. No question.
I really like that, the way Leicester was set up. I saw them against Fulham last week. They had Ndidi sort of sitting in front of the back four, giving them that protection. Then the sort of four creative midfielders. Now whether they can play all four against better sides, I don't know. Had Barnes, Maddison, Tielemans also linking neatly. He had Gray, who didn't have a great game against Fulham, but you could see that, you know, he stays wide. He's got the pace to sort of drag defences out of position because they're never going to want to give him space to run into. And then Vardy's work across the defensive line to harry them and to create spaces. You could see already that the sort of front six of that side, there's a really nice balance and link up there.
It feels like a nice match with Brendan Rodgers, do you think?
Brendan, you know, he'll bring the soul back to any club at all, just with his magnetic eyes. It's just such a breath of fresh air. He's so authentic and you know, oh, thank you. Did you hear that story about him?
No.
At Celtic. Apparently he told this story a lot when he turned up at the training ground.
Oh, yeah, I know. Yeah, carry on.
Yeah, he turned up and Danny McGrain was there, like obviously Celtic legend, fantastic fullback. And he wasn't wearing his, he was with the other coaches, but he wasn't in his club gear. He was just sort of standing there. And at the end, Brendan went over and looked deep into his eyes with his soulful and said, "Danny, what, you know, why aren't you in club kit?" And he said, "Brendan, I didn't want to put on my Celtic gear until you told me, you know, you wanted me as part of your team." And Brendan took him aside and looked deep into his eyes and shot rays of Celtic love into him and said, "Danny, as long as I'm here, you'll always have a job at this club." And he told this many times to supporters, associations, people applauded. And then after he left, Danny McGrain said, "It never happened." I don't remember that, I'm afraid. So, I mean, maybe it kind of happened and you start to exaggerate a bit. Or maybe Danny McGrain doesn't remember it. That's probably what happened there.
I did tell that story before on the pod, but nowhere near as well.
What made Danny McGrain unique in Albania between, I don't know, 1975 and 1985?
Well, he was there for 10 years.
No, I mean, in that period, he was the only person ever to do this particular thing, or have this particular thing.
A beard?
A beard is correct. Beards,
really?
Beards were banned under Enver Hoxha's government. Celtic played away at Partizan Tirana, who you may remember from a recent episode of Silent Witness. And yes. He had to get special dispensation to be allowed to go in unshaven.
Right.
Did anyone else have a beard and shave it off?
In the Celtic team, I presume not. But he was, you know, he was famous for his big
beard.
He
played as a diabetic as well, as one of the world's best right backs.
Him and Gary Mabbutt.
Yeah, you hear a lot about Gary Mabbutt, don't hear a lot about Danny McGrain.
Bournemouth 2, Newcastle 2. Another fun game. A lovely finish from Matt Ritchie at the end.
What a strike.
Did you like it that much?
Yeah.
Sort of make an involuntary noise.
I think the reason I liked it so much, when I saw it first, I thought he completely shanked it. And I don't know, I was only half paying attention or something. And I thought I could see what he was trying to do, and I thought he'd made an absolute mess of it. And then I realised he'd hit it so sweetly, it created a kind of optical illusion for me. But yeah, it was incredible strike.
That's the sort of goal that I score on one of those asphalt pitches with a light underinflated ball when I'm not really thinking about it and would never, ever be able to repeat ever again.
Some papers are making quite a big deal of the supporters who invaded the pitch celebrating that goal. I mean, it is completely different, isn't it?
It is, but they still shouldn't do it. I mean, you know, it is completely different and we shouldn't get too worked up about it. But at the same time, just don't go out the front of the stand. Stay where you are.
Tottenham approached TFL 2 years ago, wanting to change the name of White Hart Lane to Tottenham Hotspur Station. TFL demanded that Spurs would have to pay $14.7 million, or would give them Vincent Janssen, I presume. he could just drive one of the Piccadilly line trains, couldn't he? Tottenham refused. Since then, however, Spurs has been telling would-be commercial partners the station name will be changed. According to documents seen by The Guardian, it's not clear what the resolution has been, and Tottenham declined to comment. It seems that the change is going to go through, though. So there we are.
Well, Arsenal had to change the name of the
Gillespie Road.
Yeah.
Under Herbert Chapman.
Presumably they didn't pay for... I mean, why does it cost so much? I mean, presumably you just put a few stickers over the...
Well, I suppose TFL have got, you know, they've got it, haven't they? It's their property, so they can...
I find it slightly odd, because I mean, White Hart Lane is synonymous with Tottenham.
Mm.
I mean, I don't know if Gillespie Road had the same association with Arsenal back in 1932 or whatever it was when it changed.
If you don't know, I don't think anyone else
early
will.
Early 30s, whenever, you know, I guess maybe very late 20s. But I don't know, it just seems slightly needless. Manchester United have a station. Is it named? It is called Manchester United, isn't it? The train station right next to the ground.
Yeah. No, it's called Old... Oh, yeah, that's right, yeah. But why wouldn't they just get... Some airline is going to sponsor the stadium and it will be called that airline. They should just sponsor the tube station as well. They can pay that $14 million and it can be called whatever. Well, not Etihad or Emirates. Turkish Air, you know, whatever.
Okay. In the Football League, at the top of the Championship, a huge win for Sheffield United at Elland Road, leapfrogging Leeds into second. Chris Basham scored the only goal of the game late in the second half after great work from Billy Sharp. Leeds hit the post in the second half, had buckets of chances. Not sure they had a shot on target. In the last minute, Kiko Kassir was sent off for a foul outside the box on Billy Sharp. He's the keeper. He complained a lot for some reason. It was a blatant red. Pontus Janssen went in goal. Nothing better than an outfield player in goal. But they still lost. Not that that would have helped them. Norwich City are 4 points clear at the top after a 2-1 win at Rotherham. Two wins in two for Darren Morless. West Brom 1-0 at Brentford. Glorious goal from Kyle Edwards. He basically dribbled around everybody twice. They remain fourth, getting very tight below that. Just 4 points separate Middlesbrough in fifth and Nottingham Forest in 11th, which is not as tight as the bottom of League One. Walsall are in the relegation zone. They've got 42 points.
They were poor on Saturday.
Were they?
Yeah. It was a bit of a rubbish game because of the wind, but it was one of those games where, even though they took the lead after, I don't know, 3-4 minutes, whatever, I never really had any doubt that Sunderland will win it.
Anyway, they've got 42 in the relegation zone. Plymouth are 12th. They've got 45 points. So you could win and go mid-table, just like that. You probably have to win by quite a lot. Ridiculous scenes at Oxford. In the 93rd minute, Bradford unsuccessfully appealed for a penalty as one of their players went down under a challenge in the six-yard box as he shot wide. A minute later, Oxford took the lead through Jamie Mackey. That's where he is. In the 95th minute, the referee ruled the goal back and went all the way back and gave Bradford a penalty. And then 3 minutes later, he changed his mind and awarded the goal to Oxford. So a completely baffling 7 minutes between them, but it means Oxford are 19th and Bradford are bottom.
Do you think his brain's been addled by VAR?
Well, yes, I was thinking that on the way in. I mean, why not? There's so much that's become a thing that you change your mind.
Well, I'm sure that's what happened with Paul Tierney, the City Watford game. I'm sure that's, you know, he overthought the offside because there's been so much talk about offside and sort of second guessing yourself. I'm sure that's why he ended up overruling his linesman.
Of course, I mean, these things have an effect. There was that thing quite recently of technology affecting the way players train now and the way they progress through the levels because they know every movement they make. Their GPS is being tracked even in training at Premier League clubs. So players started making risk-free passes, trying to have more passes than other players. And so you've got a generation of players who behaviour has been affected by being watched in a certain way. And of course it will have the same effect on referees. We're all affected by the way technology now watches us. And of course that's going to happen to a referee who's the most watched person on the pitch. It'd be insane if their behaviour wasn't affected by it, given the way we interact. I mean, I'm sure that you, like me, write differently for the newspaper because you know 10 million angry people are going to tell you how wrong you are about Everton. I mean, technology does affect the way we act, and it's worth being aware of that.
Top two, Luton and Barnsley, they both drew in League Two. Crewe scored 5 goals in 11 minutes at home. What are you laughing at, Barnsley?
Because I really like the way you waited there thinking, yeah, this should just be cut out. And went on exactly the same tone of voice because, yeah, it's going to be cut out.
No, I was listening. I was interested.
So the fact that you knew that bit was going to be cut out there affected
your
behaviour.
I think you made a very salient point.
Right? Yeah, I do as well. I mean, I imagine this chat about whether it'll be cut out will be cut out, but I think that bit might remain. We shall see. It's up to producer Jonathan, who's already torn his he could now legitimately go to Albania in the 80s because he's torn his beard out in frustration. The top two, Luton and Barnsley, both drew in League Two. Crewe scored 5 goals in 11 minutes at home to Crawley. It finished 6-1. A great line from their manager, David Artell. He said, "We were sluggish. I told him at halftime, 4 goals in 7 minutes masked substandard performance." Leaders Lincoln play 4th place Mansfield tonight. 2nd place Bury's victory over Cambridge was postponed, which is a good result for us. Fit Bar Barry, got anything?
Dundee almost got a point against Celtic, but didn't. As Odson Edward scored in the 96th minute to give Celtic a win against the team that are second bottom of the table, which I have to say they did celebrate a little too emphatically, considering the poor quality of opposition they were facing. But Neil Lennon obviously needs wins if he's to get the job on a permanent basis. Presumably he wants it. And Celtic have a habit of popping up with late winners. That's their second in 3 matches under him, and or 3 league matches under him. And they had a couple before Brendan Rodgers left as well. So they're picking up points late doors. And Rangers continue to drop points. The Rangers drew 1-1 with Kilmarnock, which was, by all accounts, a bad-tempered game, with each side accusing the others of, you know, roughhouse tactics. And Alfredo Morales was possibly lucky to escape yet another red card. He took a swing at Kirk Broadfoot and wasn't caught by any of the match officials, so he got away with it. and Aberdeen.
VAR is going to be bad for him, isn't it? All the people.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure if he can be punished retrospectively for that. He might get away with it. I mean, it wasn't a full-blooded punch, but he did swing an arm, and considering his form and his previous, I don't know. As far as I know, he completely got away with it, so it could be possibly be punished retrospectively. Behind Rangers, Aberdeen dropped points as well. They drew with Livingston, so Celtic 10 points clear and romping to the title. Steven Gerrard is, I think, it's curious to see how he's getting on. Rangers haven't really improved. They have improved, their quality of performance has improved, but they basically, I think they're only about one or two points better off than they were under Pedro Cascina and Graham Murty last season, and I would imagine that the Rangers hierarchy were hoping for a significantly better improvement.
Thank you, Barry. That'll do for part two. In part three, we'll start with Sid in Spain. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's start in Spain with Sid Lowe. Sid, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, marvellous, thanks. Leo Messi's 51st hat-trick at Betis, and the third goal was unbelievable, wasn't it? His 29 league goals for the season. He leads the league for goals and assists. Is there any sign of him slowing down at all?
No. And even if he does slow down, there's so much to his game. There's been such an evolution in the way that he plays over the last 7, 8, 9 years that you start looking at him now and you start thinking, you know what? The day that he does slow down, he'll just become another type of brilliant player because he can genuinely do everything. You know, you have arguments about how complete a player is. I don't think anyone controls so many different elements of the game as Messi does. And so the day that Messi literally can't run anymore, you can see him sitting in the base of midfield and just passing his way through games because his touch is brilliant, because his vision is brilliant. And I realise that I'm sort of saying things that people know, but it is mind-blowing. And I actually think the consistency of Messi sometimes blinds us to how good he is, because what happens is, of course, he plays a brilliant game, he scores a hat-trick, and everybody goes, Messi hat-trick, you know, dog bites man sort of thing. It's just the same as always. That third goal, I don't know about you, but I had the sense watching it, because of the way that he hits it, and I think even using the word hit is wrong, he doesn't hit it, he kind of invites it to go into the air. Because of the way that he takes the shot on, and the way that it curls, and how gentle it is, it's like you're watching it in slow motion. It's like everybody in the stadium stops and no one moves, and they just watch this ball almost kind of like an orbiting planet go through the sky. The only person who moves, of course, is the goalkeeper, and it's always slightly out of reach. He's not even that far off his line. He's 6'2", and it still beats him. I mean, you can't call it a lob in the sense that the goalie's not miles off his line. There isn't a space to go into. It's just absolutely brilliant. And then, of course, what makes it, you know, what gives it a real impact this time round is the fact that then there's applause. There's this moment of kind of intake of breath, and there isn't really a roar when the goal goes in. There's a kind of a, oh. Yeah. And then there's applause, and then as the Barcelona players run over to celebrate with Messi, and half of them have got their heads in their hands, and some of them are just laughing their heads off. Now, that is ridiculous. What have you just done? Then the Betis fans don't just applaud him, they actually start chanting his name.
That's amazing. And the Betis keeper just gave that sort of look of, yeah, well, how do you better do, right?
It's brilliant, isn't it? That's absolutely it, isn't it? There's a look on his face that says, did you just see that?
Yeah,
you know, like, what the bloody hell do you want me to do about this?
I know you've spoken a lot on this pod about how the fact that there was league, or there is league, and now Atletico have lost 2-0 to Bilbao. There isn't league, right?
There isn't league. And you know, this kind of obviously goes hand in hand a little bit with what happened with Real Madrid, who of course lost all three competitions in 7 days. Atletico Madrid have effectively lost all two, because they were already out of the Copa del Rey, two competitions in 4 days, knocked out by Juventus in the Champions League. They were then beaten by Athletic Bilbao this weekend, and that basically puts them 10 points behind with 10 games to go. You know, you just don't see Barcelona giving up that many points now, even if Atletico would have a brilliant run between now and then the season. But I think there's something deeper as well. The response to this, and it was very interesting listening to Diego Godin post-game, both after the Juventus game, actually, but this in particular this weekend, him saying the sad thing isn't so much that we lost, is that we weren't Atletico. You know, they didn't have the aggression, they didn't have the intensity, they didn't have the level of organisation. And I think there are some questions there now about where Atletico go in terms of the evolution. So, for example, a few weeks ago I was talking to a player who'd played against Atletico Madrid, and he'd been obviously talking, as tends to happen post-game in Spain, I assume it happens in England as well, talking to the players from Atletico Madrid. And there was a real sense that actually some of those players don't really want to play like this. Some of those players would rather do more, and so it does feel now that maybe for the first time, perhaps as a consequence of them becoming a better club, a bigger club, buying better players, they're now in this position where you've got some players in the team who perhaps don't buy into some of the Atletico identity, and I think that poses a really quite interesting challenge for them, but not so much between now and next season, but ready for the new season.
Yeah, it'd be really interesting to see the changes at Atletico. It'll be really interesting to see the changes at Real Madrid. Zidane's first lineup was always going to get analysed to death, wasn't it? Isco comes in for his sixth start. Keylor Navas comes in at the expense of Thibaut Courtois. How have the changes been viewed?
Well, different people have viewed them differently, as you can probably imagine. And obviously, one of the things is that the context of this is whatever Zidane does is good. You know, that this is one of the amazing things about Zidane's arrival at Real Madrid. It almost feels like all is well with the world again. You know, this, and it doesn't change the fundamental fact, which is that Real Madrid's season is over already, and it is a disaster. But it didn't feel like a disaster at the weekend. It's like Zidane's there, everything's fine. And obviously, there's going to be bigger challenges to come when they start building for next season. And so the response of the weekend, as I say, in a way, is that whatever Zidane does is fine. I think if a different coach had made some of these changes, there would have been some question marks, because in purely footballing terms, it's very difficult to justify, for example, putting Marcelo back in ahead of Sergio Reguilón. It's difficult to justify putting Isco in when, you know, 3 or 4 days before, the club had admitted they'd opened disciplinary proceedings against him because he'd refused to go on the team bus for the previous game. Santi Solari departed, saying, you know, if you want to play, you've got to be in shape and you've got to be fit. In other words, saying, this guy isn't and he's been unprofessional. And yet, there he is back in the team. And then, obviously, with Keylor Navas, politically it's difficult because you've got a club that spent a lot of money on Thibaut Courtois in the summer, and he's put Navas in. And I think there's lots of different ways of reading it, but I think one of the simple ways of reading it, the most important ways of reading it, is to look at this and say, what Zidane really did was send a message, say, look, I decide. You know, whether it carries on this way or not, because, you know, there's 10 games to go, he'll give everyone a game. He said even afterwards, Courtois will play between then and the season. And there's an element of kind of looking at everybody. But I think more than anything else, this was a message. This was him laying down the law and saying, it's up to me now. And obviously forcing those players to effectively pay the loyalty, to buy into him, and also saying to the board of directors and to the president, listen, you want me here? I'm going to do it my way.
Sid, what, if anything, should we read into the inclusion of Gareth Bale in the starting lineup?
Right, well, Gareth Bale obviously is one of the players that has kind of been analysed to death in this inclusion of lots of players who we thought were kind of on the way out. Now, with Bale, I think it's worth putting into the context of the absentees. So there was no Casemiro, which means you have to get an extra midfielder. So one of those midfielders, creative midfielders like an Asensio or an Isco, who might have taken Bale's place, had to play in the midfield, and so Bale has a place up front. Vinicius was injured. Lucas Vazquez was injured. In a way, if you'd left Bale out there, it would have been a really quite astonishing statement. So I think him being in the team is just natural. And yet, of course, it does offer him the chance to respond, and he did play well. And I think you know, the ideal scenario probably for most people now is that Bale is moved on. But, of course, price, age and salary means that moving Bale on is going to be really very difficult.
Finally, Sid, what's the response been in Barcelona about the draw with Manchester United in the Champions League?
Well, there is a sense in Spain that Barcelona have had almost the perfect draw. Now, obviously, it's not completely perfect because I think most people believe that Porto are the weakest team in the competition. But there is a sense that given that you don't want to play Juventus, given that you don't really want to play Manchester City, and the fact, of course, that the draw is a quarterfinal and the semi-final, a pathway that says Man United, I think most people think, after Ajax and Porto, are probably the weakest team in the competition. And actually, having seen how good Ajax were against Real Madrid, United might be weaker than them, or at least that's the Spanish view on it. But a pathway that says Manchester United and then Liverpool, given the stage of the Champions League you're in, really couldn't have been much better. That said, there is an awareness that Liverpool are a very, very strong side, and there is an awareness as well, of course, that almost certainly you're going to be facing City or Juventus in the final. And yeah, that's pretty frightening.
Sid, thanks for your time.
Pleasure.
Cheers, Sid Lowe, out in Spain. From Spain, we'll go to Italy and get a roundup from Serie A, from Paolo Bandini.
Milan derby this weekend, and I have to say it was an absolute cracker. Inter won 3-2, vaulting themselves above Milan and back into third place, which really isn't the result that most people would have predicted beforehand, to be honest. Milan arrived in much better form. They began 2019 8 points behind Inter, but kicked off here 1 point ahead of them, which gives you an idea of how the season, or how the calendar year, sorry, has been going so far. Milan have conceded 5 goals in total since the start of December, which has made theirs the stingiest defence in all of Europe's top 5 leagues. And they also had a reliable goal scorer now, Krzysztof Piątek, who they acquired in January, just as Inter were about to lose one, with Mario Icardi still yet to reconcile his differences with the club after he was stripped of the captaincy last month. So despite all that, despite Inter crashing out of the Europa League with a home defeat to Eintracht Frankfurt, despite Inter having so many injuries they couldn't even fill out their bench, they somehow produced one of their best performances in weeks. They were 2-0 up in the second half, and deservedly so, before Milan started any sort of fight back with some very attacking substitutions, which wound up with Rossoneri having five forwards on the pitch. And then we had this sort of hugely entertaining helter-skelter second half, where Milan pulled one goal back, Inter then got 3-1 up with a penalty, and finally Matteo Musacchio scores to bring it back to 3-2 with 20 minutes to go, at which point it took a couple of big saves from Sami Handanovic and some last-ditch defending for Inter to hang on and win it. It's a huge result for them going into the international break. Obviously, it moves them back up to third after they have been looking in danger of dropping out of the top four. Both Roma and Atalanta, the teams in fifth and sixth place, failed to win as well. So they, most importantly, increased that gap to the teams outside the Champions League places. The other team that failed to win this weekend, or another team that failed to win, of course, was Juventus, who followed up their epic comeback against Atletico Madrid by suffering their first defeat of the Serie A season, 2-0 away to Genoa. So no unbeaten season for Massimiliano Allegri, but they are still 15 points clear in first place, so probably okay for the Scudetto. Elsewhere, there was a scary incident with David Ospina, of course, on loan from Arsenal at Napoli. He caught a knee to the face early in their win over Udinese and played on for more than half an hour after that before collapsing while sort of far away from the action. He was taken to the hospital for a CAT scan, which gave him the all clear, so good news on that front, but serious questions to be asked here about head injury protocols and how on earth he was allowed to play on in the first place for what was clearly a serious head injury.
Thank you, Paolo. In France, the big game of the weekend was Le Classique, PSG versus Marseille. PSG won 3-1, Angel Di Maria getting two and laying on an assist for Kylian Mbappe. PSG just 20 points clear of second with a game in hand and 10 games to go. Saint-Etienne beat Cannes 5-0, five different scorers. They move up to fifth. Guingamp got a huge win, taking them off the bottom above Cannes and their opponents Dijon. They're now in the relegation playoff place, but it is very tight down there. And from France, we'll go to Lucas Podolski's kebab shop, and here's Archie Rintut.
So, German football is in crisis after the three Bundesliga teams crashed out of the Champions League round of 16. I'm not sure about that, though. I would argue last season was more worrying when three of the four Bundesliga teams crashed out in the group stages, but apparently it's only now in a crisis when Bayern don't get through to the Champions League quarterfinals at least. Admittedly, things are wrong right now at two of the three clubs who went out. Biggest problems at Schalke, having their second worst season of all time, 15th in the Bundesliga, 3 points above the relegation playoff. Coach Domenico Tedesco sacked after a 7-0 defeat at Manchester City last week. Club legend Huub Stevens is in on an interim basis, but still lost 1-0 at home to Leipzig. Quick side note, at one point on Saturday, Stevens flipped out at the fourth official, paused, went back to the bench, got him a sweet and pushed it into his hand. Anyway, then you have Bayern in limbo, a coach in Niko Kovac who so far doesn't have the game plan against top quality opposition, albeit with a squad which has grown stale. Yet, still good enough to win their last three Bundesliga games, 6-0, 5-1, and again 6-0 on Sunday against Mainz, James Rodriguez with a hat-trick. But on the other hand, Dortmund are on the up, gave Spurs a better run for their money than that overall scoreline in the Champions League suggested. And even though Bayern overtook them at the top of the table on goal difference last weekend, in terms of points, Dortmund are having the third best season in their history. Saturday saw them win a 3-2 thriller at Hertha Berlin in the 93rd minute. Jadon Sancho with a delicious pass for Marco Reus to finish. Also ignored in this German football is in crisis debate is the season Eintracht Frankfurt are having in the Europa League, playing exciting football on a modest budget. Beat Inter at San Siro on Thursday night, could have won by 4 or 5, into the quarterfinals of a competition which people have complained over here about clubs not taking seriously enough in recent years. And just a point off the top four too, unbeaten in 2019 still after a 1-0 win over Nuremberg on Sunday. If you want a real crisis in German football, then just look at the DFB, the German FA. Another couple of examples from President Reinhard Grindel in the past week. He walked out of an interview when faced with questions about the Qatar World Cup, firstly, and then he criticised the manner in which coach Jurgi Löw binned off World Cup winners Mats Hummels, Jerome Boateng and Thomas Müller. It wasn't great the way that Löw did that, but in Grindel's case, people in glass houses probably shouldn't throw stones.
Thank you very much, Archie. In MLS, Wayne Rooney scored his first Major League Soccer hat-trick as DC United thrashed Real Salt Lake City 5-0. They're top of the Eastern Conference after three games of the new season.
I saw Wayne Rooney's hat-trick. It was good. Mm. One of them was a penalty. But what I really like about him there is he's obviously really enjoying it. He just looks like he's really having fun. He never stops grinning. And he obviously likes his teammates. I think it's a really nice little tail end to his career. Not that it's a very valid league in itself.
Well, one would imagine he has a much easier time of it over there because he doesn't have newspapers constantly on his case and scrutinising his every move, and he can presumably walk the streets of Washington undisturbed.
They like him. You know, they're really pleased to have him there. It must be really fun for him.
Over in Greece, the derby between Panathinaikos and Olympiakos on Sunday was abandoned after 70 minutes with the away team 1-0 up amid violence and tear gas. Home fans clashed with police and attacked the Olympiakos bench. The referee stopped play, then called off the game half an hour later. It is an international break. We haven't done the squads. We're going to go big into that on Thursday. We'll, of course, react to the result of Wales friendly with Trinidad and Tobago and look ahead to the Euro qualifiers. Ireland, Barry, there's a story regarding the FAI and its chief executive. Do you know more?
Yeah, a story emerged over the weekend that John Delaney, the controversial, shall we say, chief exec of the Football Association of Ireland, had loaned his employers €100,000 of his own money. The Sunday Times came up with this story and were ready to publish it, and he tried and failed to get an injunction to prevent them publishing the story. No one quite knows why he loaned the Football Association of Ireland €100,000 or why they needed a loan of €100,000. He said it was a bridging loan because they had a cash flow problem. Doesn't sound particularly feasible or realistic. There are other stories doing the rounds as to possible reasons why he might have loaned them €100,000, but our lawyers would not thank me for saying them on the pod, unfortunately. And they've basically issued two statements about it, not really clearing up anything with either, and have said they'll talk further about it in April, which just sounds like a stalling tactic in the hope that the problem will just go away, which I doubt it will. It's bound to be the main topic of conversation at press conferences this week, which obviously is far from ideal for Mick McCarthy, who probably almost certainly has nothing whatsoever to do with it, wasn't in the job when this loan was made, I think last year or the year before, and won't want to talk about it, but will be asked about it nonetheless.
Maybe, you know, he just loves his employers so much, he's happy to help them out. Would you lend The Guardian some money if they called you, Barry?
I wouldn't loan them money, but, you know, I'm pretty lapse when it comes to claiming expenses I'm entitled to. So that's kind of not even a loan, it's more of a gift.
Probably about 2011, I did lend The Guardian £75, which actually kept the whole operation. I've never asked for it back, I'm presuming.
Two great company men you are. Adam says, it's a popular pastime for some football journalists to churn out books more frequently than they have birthdays. But I believe Barry is yet to join their ranks. If he was to pen his first book, what would it be about?
I won't pen a book. I have had offers.
Have you?
Yeah.
Sorry. I've never seen Jonathan so surprised.
Yes, I have had offers and I've declined them because I'm too lazy. I've had a good idea for a book, but the actual thought of having to sit down and write it is...
Why don't you tell Jonathan he'll do it?
I'm not sure he'd be interested in it, but there are too many bad books out there already, and particularly bad sports books, and I've no wish to add to the pile.
Matt asks, and I think Jonathan will know the answer to this, if you're at a cinema, which armrest is yours?
I've never been to a cinema busy enough where that was ever an issue.
You've never been to the movies on a Saturday night?
I mean, in the days when I went quite regularly, and I don't go as often as I used to. I used to like going sort of, you know, lunchtime matinee when I was ideally the only person in the room.
Hang on, you've never sat next to anyone in a cinema before?
Well, Only friends.
Have you sat down in seats where there's been another person there and then they've immediately moved away? And how many times?
No, that's never happened.
Going to the cinema when it's busy is profoundly unpleasant the because great, people just don't know how to behave themselves in cinemas.
The great Hungarian coach, Martin Bukovi, when he lived in Greece, he didn't have a television, but he was a huge fan of cinema. So he would come home from training pretty much every day and go to the cinema. And it was, this is in the 60s, so it was the height of cinema when there was a lot of cinemas about. He was I think he's Olympiakos, so he was in Piraeus. But he hated going to the cinema with anybody else because he hated having conversations. He wanted to concentrate on the film. So his wife was also a big fan of the cinema. So she would go to the cinema. He would come in from training. He would then go out again, go to the box office and ask if his wife was there. And if his wife was there, he'd go to a different cinema. And I admire that.
What a lovely way to end. Thanks, Jonathan, for your time.
It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Barney. Nice to see you.
Thanks for having me.
Cheers, Baz.
You're welcome.
We'll be back on Thursday.